The status of reform and conservative marriage, how do we understand that in terms of Manzares, that when they're through the divorce, they get a civil divorce, and I've heard that many times the children are not considered mamzerim, it wasn't a valid condition?
Yeah, well, this is, of course, a gift from Hashem to many, many Balei Tshuva. The obvious problem that a Baal Tshuva might face is the divorce rate in the world, in the United States, is, of course, increasing. Many people are children of second marriages, and we do have a problem that if a Jewish woman had a first marriage to a Jewish man, and there was a civil divorce without a religious divorce, so technically the woman is still married, and if she therefore marries another Jewish man, the kid is born from adultery, and a child that is born from adultery is called a mamzer. Again, be sure you understand this. I'm sure many of you know this, but just to be 100% sure, although we commonly translate mamzer as illegitimate child, that's not really the halachic definition. A child born out of wedlock is not a mamzer. Okay, there's no problem with that. There's a problem with living out of wedlock, of course, but that does not affect the child. But a child that is born out of adultery of the wife is a mamzer. So now this is not an aguna situation. We're not talking about a case where first husband is bad guy and he's withholding a get. They didn't care. They didn't know. They just got a civil divorce. If you're living a conservative reform life, you don't care about it. But what happens if 30 years later or 25 years later, child becomes a Baal Tshuva, becomes religious, all of a sudden he discovers he might be a mamzer, God forbid, who could not marry into Klal Yisrael. So Rav Moshe Feinstein had a very well-known tshuva where Rav Moshe Feinstein made the argument that since you only need a get, a Jewish divorce, if it was a halachic marriage, the conservative and reform marriages are not halachically valid to begin with. Now, why is that so? It's important to know this. What makes a marriage kosher or pasul is not who the rabbi is. The fact that a conservative rabbi officiated would not make it pasul. The thing that makes a marriage kosher or pasul are the witnesses who are designated to witness the marriage. They are the most important people in the marriage. Now, to be a kosher witness, of course, you have to have two of them. They have to be male. They have to be above bar mitzvah. They cannot be related to each other or to the chassan or the kala. And most importantly, they themselves have to be halachically observant, which would basically mean they keep Shabbos and kosher. And other than that, there might be other questions. But certainly, if they don't keep Shabbos, they are not kosher witnesses. So Rav Moshe Feinstein argued in a very famous psak that since in the conservative and reform marriage, you normally do not have kosher witnesses, there is no marriage. If there is no marriage, you don't need a get. If you don't need a get, a woman who gets out of her first marriage with a civil divorce is not committing adultery. Therefore, the second marriage, there will not be a mamzer. And even if the second marriage was a conservative and reform marriage, that's not going to be a problem. Because at worst, that'll just mean the kid is born out of wedlock. Okay, it's important to know that. People who don't understand the lumdus here, they sometimes say, if Rav Moshe is invalidating the first marriage, she would also invalidate the second marriage. Well, maybe that's true. But invalidating the second marriage is not going to create mamzeris as long as the first marriage was not valid. So this has been a real Pesach, a real opening, a real basis of salvation for many, many, many people who would otherwise, chas v'shalom, have the stigma of mamzeris. And this is certainly how a place like Or Sameach follows and the like. I just want to point out that it is not a universal opinion, meaning to say there is a makom in halacha where even if the first marriage was invalid, it may still require a get for the following lumdus. That is, we know that the Mishnah in Kedushin says that a marriage may be created by intercourse as well as the giving of money. Right? There are three ways you can make a marriage. Kesef, which is giving money or money's worth, that would be the ring. Shtar, giving a document to the woman. And the third is actual consummation. So the argument goes, even if the first marriage was not kosher because of the lack of witnesses, it's similar, lahavdil, to the idea of a common law marriage in secular law. If the husband and the wife live together as husband and wife, And they are known by at least some Orthodox kosher witnesses to be living as husband and wife. That itself may halachically turn into a marriage by bia. So even if it was pasul at its inception, it may become a kosher marriage by virtue of cohabitation with the knowledge of some religious Jews. And therefore, l'chatchila, we actually try to get a get. We try to obtain a get. Rabbi Yashu, for example, paskin l'chatchila, even a conservative reform marriage, one should endeavor to get a get, to receive. But nevertheless, b'di'eved, if a child was already born from a second marriage, so you couldn't fix it, Rabbi Yashiv also said that the children are not mamzerim. I actually had my own case. I may have mentioned it before. The one time I was zocha to ask Rabbi Yashiv b'shaila, when I was a rabbi in America, we had a situation where there was a shaila of a mamzer. A person was born from a second marriage, and he was 35. And in order for him to avoid the problem of a mamzer, we needed to determine if his mother's first marriage was halachically valid. Now, the mother's first marriage occurred in 1954. So we had to somehow figure out, in 1954, were there kosher witnesses, were there not kosher witnesses? Now, how do you do that? That would be pretty hard. But miraculously, the rabbi, the Orthodox rabbi of that community, which was in Massachusetts, was living in the Washington area with his daughter. He was retired at that point. And although he knew nothing about this woman and her first husband, but he knew the chazan, who was supposedly Masadar Kedushin at this chazna. And the problem is the chazan was his chazan, the Orthodox chazan. But he said, no Orthodox person liked this chazan, and this chazan used to always take non-Orthodox people to be his witnesses. Now, all that's circumstantial evidence. He didn't give us eyewitness testimony about this wedding. He just said, as a general rule, this chazan didn't use Orthodox witnesses. So we collected all of this evidence, we tape recorded it, etc., and I was able to go to Rebbe Yachov and ask him, is this enough to establish that the first marriage was not valid? And of course, you're only given, when Rebbe Yachov was alive, you were only given at most 30 to 40 seconds to kind of say your shayla. You know, you had to talk real quick and then they would kick you out. But I managed to get an answer that b'di'evet, you could be somech even on that circumstantial evidence and the person would not be a mamzer. Okay? But as I say, there were poskim that argued. In other words, there is a lumdus that Rav Moshe's tshuva is not self-evident, simply because living together with Shemishas can make it a marriage later.
And how would you reply to that?
So Rav Moshe's argument was the following. Rav Moshe's argument was that when people think they're married, when they live together, they don't have kavana to make a marriage. In other words, Rav Moshe argues that bia is kedushin only when you have kavana that you want it to be kedushin. But if you're bayo because you think you're already married, you're not bayel l'shem kedushin, you're bayel al das kedushin harishonim. Now, Rav Moshe's colleague, who is a little less known than Rav Moshe, but still a very, very great gadol, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, actually argued, you don't need bayel l'shem kedushin, you need bayel l'shem ishus, meaning you have to be bayel to express a relationship of husband and wife, but it doesn't have to be l'shem ishus. So according to Rav Henkin, you'd have a big chumrah that reform marriages, civil marriages, all of these in Yonim would turn into kedushin. But Rav Moshe says no. Whenever a person thought he was married, the bia is not l'shem kedushin. And if it's not l'shem kedushin, you don't need a get. Now, when Rav Moshe came out with that tshuva, many conservative reform rabbis were very upset. They said, oh, he's insulting us. He's saying we're not legitimate. He's saying... But you have to know that this was a tremendous, tremendous tova for not that Rav Moshe specifically said, I'm going to do something good for people. But Lamaisa, this psak really, really, I don't know how many people here are maybe have that situation, but I can certainly tell you that over the decades, there are probably hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people of Balei Tshuva in particular, who were saved from the stigma and difficulty of Mamzeris based on this psak. So this psak has been a tremendous, tremendous bracha for Am Yisrael in that way. According to who? So the difference would be. Rav Hankin, you're right. Theoretically, it might be, but the difference would be this. The difference would be that everybody's moda, that kiddushin through bia, does require kavana that you're expressing a marital bond. Rav Moshe says it has to be kavana to make a marriage. Rav Hankin says kavana that you are married is good enough. But when the bia is not for the kavana of being married, hakol moedim, it wouldn't make a marriage. That's why an affair, if you're living together with a girlfriend, you do not require a get, even like Rav Hankin. Otherwise, you'd have a lot of trouble there. We don't require gittin when people are living with their girlfriends and they break up. Again, not that they should do that. Of course, they shouldn't do that. But you do not require a get. Yeah.
I was in a Jewish museum recently, and I was there this morning, and they had old Samin containers, and they had that castle shape that we see everywhere today.
Yes.
I was wondering what's the source of that.
The idea of the castle-shaped besamim, I really don't know if there's any mucker for that. It's just, decorative. It might be the idea, I'm thinking, a remes to the heavenly Jerusalem, right? We say there's the Yerushalayim above and the Yerushalayim below, and the heavenly is opposite the earthly. And Shabbos, we experience Olam Haba, so we're connected. Baruch Hashem, you're in the physical Yerushalayim, but let's say the person in Germany or Poland or whatever, so he was not connected to the earthly Jerusalem, but on Shabbos he was connected to the spiritual Jerusalem. And the castles and turrets were a medieval representation of Yerushalayim, having all of these palaces and the like. Was this museum here or in France? Yeah, I just want to tell you an interesting thing, that Hitler, Yimach Shmo, Hitler was very confident that he would eradicate the entire Jewish world. But Hitler had one reservation. He says, if I kill all the Jews, nobody's going to know what I did. Nobody's going to know my great, great accomplishment. Right? Because there are no Jews around. So this is what he did. He collected a vast, vast museum of artifacts from the Jewish communities that were destroyed. And he was planning on making a huge museum in Prague about all the Jewish culture and how and all the things that it had. And that would show the world what he destroyed. So Lemaisa, after the war, a lot of those artifacts were recovered, and they were put on exhibit. So I remember it was traveling around the world. This was around 25 years ago, called The Precious Legacy. And it actually came to the Smithsonian in Washington. And I went to see it. And it had a lot of the Havdalah things and a lot of plates and a lot of things. Now, I have to admit, it didn't interest me tremendously. You see one Besamim box, you see a lot of Besamim boxes, et cetera. But as I'm walking by, I notice in a case a yellowed notebook, like an old notebook. Well, it's a notebook, what is it, receipts, And you know what it was? It was the actual Ksav Yad, the actual manuscript of the Neida Yehuda, the Rav of Prague in 1700s, one of the greatest Gedolei Achronim. And he wrote many Svarim, and one of the most important Svarim in Maseches Brachos is the Sefer Tzlach. Tzlach is an abbreviation, Tzion LaNefesh Chaya, and this was the Ksav Yad of the Tzlach. Now most people, just walked by, they just, notebook, they didn't even bother to stop. But that was the thing that was really, just to imagine, to have the, see the Ksav Yad of the Neida Yehuda, right? So it depends how you define your precious legacy. Is the precious legacy the gold and the silver? Or is the precious legacy the Chidushei Torah and then the Psak Halacha of our great Gedolim? But yeah, my guess would be, I didn't see it clearly, that the motif of castles and palaces is to correspond to Yerushalayim. Because if you look at any medieval pictures of Jerusalem, you'll always see that they imagined it as palaces and castles and everything else. Because once again, we always imagine things based on our culture. Have you seen the Sukkot poster, Simchas Beis HaShoeva? The ceremony of the water drawing, which is the time of the Beis HaMikdash. They used to draw the water, right? So they represent all the people wearing shtreimels and kapotas, as if to say, in the time of the Mishnah, that's exactly, what they wore. Everybody envisions it the way they have it. So the same way, medieval Europe had all of these castles and everything, so that's how they envisioned Jerusalem at the time. Yeah.
When Saul and David were fighting, they had a civil war. I have a bit of a double barrel question. First of all, how did the dynamics of two kings actually work? And second of all, what was Saul's halakhic justification for wanting to kill David? And why didn't David go and face trial?
Yeah, the problem was that both halakhically and in terms of the biblical narrative, there were not two kings, meaning to say David did not become king till Saul was killed in war. So technically, Saul was still king. And even, by the way, in the book of Shmuel, even after Saul died, David was king in Hebron for 7 years, and a lot of the people did not acknowledge him. It's only 7 years later he went to Jerusalem, and then he was king for 33 years, a total of 40 years. So technically, Saul's perspective was that as long as he's still king, then David HaMelech, who's trying to, who was anointed as king, is a moreh, is a rebelling against the king, and as a result is chayav misa. David did not want that war. David did not perceive of Shaul as a rival for Keretz. David HaMelech perceived Shaul as the legitimate Mashiach Hashem, the anointed king of God, until such time as Shaul would die. But Shaul, again, how do you understand Shaul? Shaul is a complicated character. Did Shaul have mental illness? Was Shaul a paranoid? You know, there are different issues. You know, what category we put on Shaul. But it's very, very clear that he was troubled. And the Navi describes it as the Spirit of God had departed from him. And one has to understand how tragic that was. Shaul was a great person. Shaul was a Navi. And when the Spirit of Hashem left him, that's so devastating. He's no longer connected to Hashem. He no longer has that source of prophecy. And that created great despair and sadness and eventually rage. And part of the rage was that he saw that Hashem had now favored David over him. And to add to that, his own son, Yonasan, is David's best friend. And you can see how much this disturbed Shaul, that he almost killed his own son. Do you remember the famous scene when he wanted David to show up at a party at Rosh Chodesh and David wasn't there because David was hiding, because David was warned that this would be a time that his father, that Shaul would try to attack him, and Shaul threw a spear in his rage at his own son. So I think halachically we would really not describe this as a civil war. We would describe this as David simply trying to protect his life by gathering the people who supported him. He was not interested in deposing Shaul. He was not interested in killing Shaul. There was at least two times he could have killed Shaul, and he did not. And David always regarded Shaul as the Mashiach of Israel. And one has to remember this, because as complicated a character as Shaul is, and it's very, very difficult to understand, he was considered to be righteous and holy, and the one that Hashem chose to be the first king over Bnei Israel. So I would just dispute the characterization of it as a civil war. It essentially was a war waged by one side only, with the other side seeking nothing more than self-preservation. Okay.
Yeah. For embarrassing someone in public, we know on the one hand, I'm not being paid for very rubbing and this, and then I've seen the Gemara saying, like, someone who says Shema in a strange way, you must ask him, and then I feel a bit as if I'm a paragraph. And then, how do we judge? Like, what about where a case where the Gemara doesn't speak about what's particular?
Well, you have to understand that the specific rules in the Mishnah, that if somebody says certain prayers twice, you get rid of them right away, like those variety shows, they would take a curved cane and pull him off the stage, etc. It is not because, please understand, it is not because he's not reading properly. It's not because he's not pronouncing the words. It's not because he's violating the etiquette of tefillah. If that would be the only issue, then after he finishes, we would tell, you know, we would either not ask him again or we would talk to him privately. We would not publicly embarrass somebody. You don't publicly embarrass somebody because his reading is not good. You have to understand that the problem there was the Mishnah was written at a time when sects like Christianity were still trying to infiltrate Judaism. Remember, Christianity initially was a distorted sect within Judaism. Just like today, you have the Hebrew Christians or the Jews for Yashka, etc. Well, that's what Christianity was. It was not even a separate religion. And consequently, there were certain buzzwords. If they repeated certain words, there were allusions to the Trinity, or there were allusions to multiple gods. So the problem here is not that somebody is not reading Hebrew right. The problem is that we suspect, and there were grounds for doing so, that the person was a member of a heretic sect, and as a result, he was praying to idolatrous ideas, idolatrous religion. So at that point, you have to be very, very decisive. You have to not allow that type of apicorsis to penetrate. So it would be very, very rare that you would be confronted with that situation today. Now, it might be. If I discovered that my chazan is a member of Jews for Yashka, it would be appropriate for me to remove him right away because he's offering prayers to idolatry. And sometimes it's hard to know. You should know. I mean, since a Jew for Yashka, or Messianic Christian is the more accurate term today, he may look like a religious person, may have a beard, may have sitches out, etc., and the like. So they can fool you. They can fool you. In fact, it's little. I don't even want to say that they're deliberately fooling you. I mean, they believe that, you know, this is Judaism. But that's you know, idolatrous and the like. So there is a difference there.
But what about, like, if I saw someone embarrassing someone in public, then should I embarrass that person or should I have
it? It depends on the situation. But even then, I would simply go back to the idea that two wrongs don't make a right. I mean, basically, I would go over to the person and I would say, can I talk to you now? I need to talk to you right now. And, you know, try to make it right now. And then tell the person, you know, you really cannot talk to another person this way. It's a great, great avera, and it's improper. You know, even then, now if Lamaisa, though, the only way you can stop him embarrassing Reuven is by embarrassing Shimon, then you can do it, because in a sense, the embarrasser is like a rodef. Because since embarrassing somebody is like murdering him, so what's the halacha if somebody's about to kill somebody? I can take him out. But rodef is a very good analogy, because what is the din of rodef if I could save the victim by doing something less than killing the person? Like I could, you know, break his arm. You're mechuyev to do the least you can accomplish the goal. So this is exactly the way you do it. If I can stop the embarrassment by something short of embarrassing the rodef, then I have to do it. If I cannot, then I'm allowed to take that extreme measure. It's a good analogy. In other words, just look at public embarrassment as rodef, to kill somebody, and then apply the laws of rodef. Yeah.
I understand that every Rosh Chodesh, thousands of Jews go via military escort to Joseph's grave in the West Bank. They're in armored buses, and they're consistently stones thrown at the buses, and the tires are on fire and all that jazz. That's what I've heard. Given the hostility of the area and this, I guess, at least apparent danger, is this a not recommend thing to do? Is there like a halakha problem going there, you know, in the face of that and that kind of, you know, when there's that hostility present?
Well, as a general rule, of course, we're not supposed to put ourselves in danger, and that is a halakha. That's why you don't do bungee jumping, although when I mention bungee jumping as an example, people give me statistics that apparently bungee jumping is safer than driving and bicycling, and, you know, it's like safer than anything, you know, okay. Right. It's only like one out of every, you know, million or 2 million miles or something, okay. But but be it as it may, there is a concept that we don't deliberately do dangerous things. But the question becomes, it really is a question of degree, because the statement cannot mean what it says. Don't do things that are dangerous. Well, if you're not allowed to do things that are dangerous, then you're not going to get out of bed in the morning. Walking outside is dangerous. And by the way, staying in bed is dangerous. I remember in Washington, I mean, it's not funny, but it happened. An 8-year-old kid, you know, was just shot through the wall of his bedroom because it was in a drug-infested neighborhood. And the guy's in bed and gets shot to death. So LMI, so we qualify it. It's not forbidden to do dangerous things. It's forbidden to do things that are excessively dangerous, unreasonably dangerous. I mean, that's the getter. But that's extremely difficult to quantify. What is, right? Because otherwise, you can't drive. Certainly, going on a naked bus is absolutely dangerous. I don't mean because of, God forbid, suicide bombers. I mean the driving of the bus. the driving of the bus itself, you know, can be quite dangerous. So there is a concept, though, that in a way society defines it, meaning to say something that most people regard as ordinary, safe, normal. So we quote the pasuk, Shomer Pesoyim Hashem, Hashem guards foolish people. So in a sense, therefore, once you have a critical mass of people who consider this to be something that is an appropriate activity, and they have, you know, the guards and everything else, so it then becomes an activity that is acceptable, and it's nichlal into the divine promise of Shomer Pesoyim Hashem. Now, again, I understand there's so many questions. Well, how many people do that? Are we talking about you need 1 million people to do it? You know, I mean, do you have the numbers that make it a socially accepted activity? I don't know. But the truth of the matter is, are you aware of, I know there have been some incidents, but I mean, most of the trips, nothing happens, right? I mean, people throw stones, but nothing happens in particular. So I wouldn't encourage it per se, but I don't think we could say it's halachically necessary. If there's an army escort, and if the buses are bulletproof buses, that's considered to be a reasonable hishtadlus to allow you to go ahead and do it. But you know, I just want to say one thing, that the general idea of going to the graves of the righteous and praying, whether it be the Kever of Yosef, whether it be Maras HaMachpelah, whether it be to the Mount of Olives, whether it be to Tzfat, right? Many people go to Tzfat. There certainly is an inyan of praying at the grave of a tzaddik, but many, many gedolim have actually said that the learning and the davening and the tzedakah that you do in yeshiva is actually worth more, meaning to say, if I have 6 hours, right? So I have a choice, let's say, of going to a grave in which I won't be learning for that time. Of course, you could do some learning as well, but let's say the choice is visiting the grave or learning morning seder or something like that. So the hachra would generally be that the learning is a bigger success, and one should focus on that. Yeah.
I've recently heard a criticism that since Judaism is based on this one chosen nation and all the others are lesser, do we just live with that criticism as a reality, or is there like a better way?
Well, you know, facts are facts. You know, we can't change it. But one way of looking at it is this: though, I think it's important to understand that chosenness is really fundamentally a responsibility, and if anything, it's a burden on us that Hashem expects more of us. This week, we're going to read the Tochacha. The Tochacha at the end of Vayikra, the awesome curses, the awesome punishments that will befall the Jewish people because they don't keep the Torah. And this doesn't happen to the other nations to the same degree. Because when God has chosen you to be his nation, you have more responsibility. And therefore, there are more consequences when we don't keep the Torah. That's one thing to keep in mind. Therefore, it's not like we're the chosen people, so we're reclining on our thrones and putting grapes in our mouths while the non-Jews are, you know, fanning us and everything else. First of all, that hasn't been the reality of Jewish history, as everybody knows. So if anybody could complain about being chosen, it might be the Jews instead of the Gentiles who were not chosen under those circumstances. The other thing to keep in mind, and I'm going to use a crude analogy, but I think it's helpful, that imagine a Jewish soul as a gas tank. Imagine a soul as a gas tank. A gas tank meaning it has a potentiality to be filled with Kedusha. So we would say a Jewish soul is a 16-gallon tank, and a non-Jewish soul is only a 10-gallon tank. The potentiality for holiness of a Jewish soul is greater. But if you have a 16-gallon tank that only has 1 gallon, it actually has less Kedusha than a 10-gallon tank that has 10 gallons. So we cannot say, you know, people sometimes say, well, what about Mother Teresa, you know, such a righteous, you know, Gentile woman? Are we saying that the lowliest Jew, you know, is better and more beloved than Mother Teresa? So my response might be, that if Mother Teresa's tank was 10 gallons full, then indeed she might have a deeper relationship with God than somebody whose gas tank is only 1 gallon full or even empty. So if you look at it in terms of potentiality as opposed to actualization, then I think that still means that the non-Jew who truly wants to live by the will of God might in fact be on a higher level than the Jew who does not want to live by the will of Hashem. Right? That might help. Now, people will still ask the question, well, is it fair that God creates neshamos with different capacities, 16-gallon, 10-gallon, you know, etc.? Well, we create cars with different capacities. I mean, neshamas come in different varieties, and it's also important to remember that according to halacha, non-Jews who keep the seven commandments of Noach do have a share in the world to come. That's a very important rule. Judaism is almost unique in this. It might be unique that we are a religion that says you don't have to be Jewish to attain eternal salvation with the Almighty. Now, Christianity, although they try to sugarcoat it in recent years, because you know, it's politically incorrect, but the historical Christian response has been that you can only be saved if you believe in Yashka. You don't believe in Yashka, you have eternal damnation. Islam certainly believes that. Judaism says you don't have to be Jewish to be connected to God in Olam Haba. So that itself, I think, is a very, very powerful statement. That's why we don't proselytize. The only proselytization that the Rambam says we're supposed to do, and Chabad does it, he's the only one that really does it, is we're supposed to try to encourage the non-Jewish world to keep the seven Noahide laws. But we don't encourage a non-Jew to keep Shabbos or kosher or become Jewish. So those are just things to think about. Now, it doesn't totally answer the question, but if you put it in perspective, the question becomes a little less intense than it might otherwise be.
I heard that the Bala Tanya was the first to introduce the idea, or one of the first, that there's a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul, and that sort of got him in trouble as well. What was the mainstream idea before that?
Yeah, this is an interesting idea. The Baal HaTanya is not the first, but the Baal HaTanya did emphasize it. If you look at the Rambam, in other words, what I said about capacity and stuff, the Rambam in the Mora Nevuchim does not really talk about a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul. The Rambam talks about a soul. And the Rambam looked at the world, as you might call, as a strict meritocracy, meaning your standing with Hashem depends on what you do with what Hashem gave you. You do good deeds, you're righteous. You don't do good deeds, you're evil. And there's no intrinsic qualitative difference between a Jew and a non-Jew other than the obligations that you fulfill that bring you closer to Hashem. So you're correct. In the Rambam's writings, which was the main source of rationalist philosophy, of Jewish philosophy in the Middle Ages, there was no notion of the uniqueness of the Jewish soul. However, the one sefer that diametrically argued with the Rambam was the earlier sefer, earlier than the Rambam, and that is the Kuzari of Rav Yehuda Halevi. Rav Yehuda Halevi very much emphasized the qualitative difference of the Jewish soul, and the Baal HaTanya, in turn, drew very heavily on the Kuzari, and of course the Kabbalists did it as well. So in Kabbalah, the notion of the uniqueness of the Jewish soul became almost an article of faith. I would just point out that according to the Rambam, that wasn't necessarily the case. That is why you will sometimes find, by people who are using improper language, that they will accuse the Baal HaTanya, they will accuse Chabad of having racist tendencies, because Chabad is basically, based on this idea, is basically characterizing people based on how they were born without looking at what they do. But that's based on Rav Yehuda Halevi, and in turn that was taken over by the Mekubalim in many, many ways. I would also point out, though, that whether it's the Baal HaTanya or the Kuzari, there is a concept of Geirus. So you really can't describe Judaism as racist, because whatever the superiority of the Jewish soul is, it is lamaisa open to anybody who wants to embrace it. It's not a question of being born into it. You can embrace it, and then your soul gets enlarged or enhanced. You know, it's not clear exactly what the process of conversion is. Some people say anyone who converted had a Jewish soul to begin with. Others look at it, you get a new soul in the process of conversion. So at least that would negate the racist accusation, because racism is something that is immutable, unchangeable, based on the accident of birth.
Is there such a concept as a avera for which there is no tshuva? And if not, what about Elisha ben Avera?
Yeah, well, the pashtus, you know, there's of course the Zohar. The Zohar says that if a person emits semen in vain, there is no tshuva. But I want to add immediately that all of the Svarim, without single exception, say that the Zohar just means tshuva is difficult, and sometimes the lashon "there's no tshuva" is a reference to the difficulty of breaking a certain habit, and it does not refer to the impossibility of it. So if you look at the Rambam, I mean, the Rambam seems to tell us, this is his lashon, that there is no sin in the world for which you cannot do tshuva. Now, that doesn't mean tshuva is easy. I mean, people ask the question, could Hitler have done tshuva? Well, yes, Hitler could have done tshuva, but that doesn't mean, but it's not like the Christian tshuva. It's not like you go to a priest and say, I'm sorry, and the priest says you're forgiven. Our tshuva sometimes requires punishments, it requires purification, it requires a lot of things. It's not cheap grace, as the expression goes. But yes, at the end of the day, there can be tshuva for that. There can be tshuva for everything, even though there may be a difficult purification process. Now, Elisha ben Avuya, right? Elisha ben Avuya was the famous Tana. He was the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir, a very, very big Talmud Chacham. And he became a heretic. I know you all remember the story, because he saw a boy climb a tree to chase away a bird to retrieve eggs because of his father. His father asked him to get the eggs, and the boy fell off the tree, and the boy died. And Elisha ben Avuya said, there are only two commandments in the Torah, where the Torah says if you keep those commandments, you get long life. One is honoring your parents, and the other is sending away the bird to retrieve the eggs. Here the kid did both, and he dies. The whole Torah must be a lie. There's no God, there's no justice. It's all made up. And he became a heretic. Actually, if you look at the Yerushalmi, you actually see a little different. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, but, you know, as we like to, he always had it in him, meaning to say that even beforehand, he used to read Greek philosophy and all sorts of other things, and even at his bris, it mentions that his father had seen that when the Chachamim came to the bris, there was a fire from God surrounding them, and he said, oh, I want my son to learn Torah, so he'll be like that, so there was a motive, shalom v'shma, that tainted everything, okay, whatever it would be. But if you remember, the one thing about Elisha ben Avuya that's very notable is that even when he was like riding a horse and eating a non-kosher food on Yom Kippur, which fell on Shabbos, the world always likes Yom Kippur on Shabbos, you know, so he's Mechalel Shabbos and he's violating Yom Kippur and he's eating treif, and Rav Meir is following him by foot, asking him questions in Torah. And Elisha ben Avuya is answering the questions. And when he reaches the limit of Shabbos, he only walked 2,000 amos from the city, he told Rabbi Meir, you can't go any further, you have to stop. Now this is pretty amazing, because what this indicates is that although Elisha ben Avuya rejected Yiddishkeit, he was not trying to entice other people. The other way around, he wanted Rabbi Meir to stay religious and to keep the halacha. He told Rabbi Meir, you can't go past here. And Rabbi Meir asked his Rebbe, why don't you do tshuva? And Elisha ben Avuya said, I heard a voice from heaven say, return my children, except for Acher, this other one. Right, so I assume that's what you're referring to when the Gemara seemed to say there was no tshuva. But again, the Svarim HaKadoshim basically tell us that Acher could have done tshuva as well. But Hashem basically said, I'm not going to help you out on this one. You have to make the effort yourself. Meaning normally in tshuva, Hashem gives us great, great assistance. When a person is a great Rasha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes says to him, you dug this hole. It's your responsibility to get out of it. So Elisha ben Avuya misinterpreted the message. He was hopeless. He gave up hope. He was despair. He was in despair. But in fact, even for Acher, there would have been tshuva.
So, Gemara and Erevin in Nun Gimel, Nun Dal, you're learning, you're not speaking out, you're learning silently, and I just wondering, like, what is the actual thing Yosef in this, like, Talmud Torah? How are you actually
going to be talking about it? Yeah. In other words, Gemara in Erevin certainly says that when you learn, even when you're learning by yourself, you're supposed to learn out loud. Now, out loud doesn't mean you have to be screaming, but, you know, but you should vocalize the words. And this is considered to be a skula for remembering your learning. By the way, Rebbe Yashiv, when he would learn by himself, Rebbe Yashiv usually didn't have a chavrusa, he would actually explain everything. He wouldn't just say the words. He would explain in Yiddish. The Gemara, he would say, so the Gemara asks the Kasha, you'd think he had a chavrusa with him. So I remember reading, his next door neighbor, who was also a chashev Talmud Chacham, said he learned all of Masechet Shabbos b'chavrusa with Rebbe Yashiv without Rebbe Yashiv knowing it. Rebbe Yashiv was learning Masechet Shabbos like from 2 in the morning to 6, 4 hours a day. He says, he would just sit there and says, he had a wonderful lesson. The frick to Gemara, the Gemara asks, the Gemara answers. Tysus, and he would go over at Tysus. He would say, Tysus has three kashas. Okay, Tysus has three kashas, and this is his teretz. And then Rebbe Yashiv would say, how does this teretz answer each of the questions? So this answer answers kasha one. So he says he learned the whole Masechus. I don't know why he didn't continue, but he says that for around a year, he would have a four-hour chavrusa with Rebbe Yashiv. Although Rebbe Yashiv didn't know he had a chavrusa. But anyway, so certainly that's actually a very good way to learn. You're talking things out and you understand it. But if you're asking me, are you mekayem the mitzvah d'oraisa of Talmud Torah with your thinking about Torah, the answer is yes, you are. You are. Because the Lashon in the book of Yoshua is v'hagisa b'yam v'layla. See, it's interesting. In the Torah, one of the mitzvahs of Talmud Torah is v'dibarta b'am. You should speak in Torah. On the other hand, another pasuk just says learn Torah. So learning wouldn't require speech. And in Yoshua, it says v'hagisa b'am. You should think about Torah. So l'maisa, we do paskin that one fulfills Talmud Torah with thinking. But it is preferable indeed to speak out what you're learning, because that brings it into your neshama in a deeper level. Yeah.
Have Dolim in the last 50 or 100 years mentioned anything about global warming, whether it's man-made or not, what a responsibility is, specifically what the Dolim have said about it?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're raising I imagine you're intimating something with the question, perhaps, and that is. That sometimes one wonders, Gedolim don't seem to get involved so much in what you might consider world issues. Right? Gedolim will talk about things that pertain to the Jewish community, our learning, our davening, etc. Whether yeshiva boys should be drafted in the military, you know, Gedolim might get involved in those issues. But what about, you know, world poverty, world hunger, global warming is one particular example. B'derech klal, I think you are correct. We do not have too many pronouncements about those issues. One might legitimately raise the question, why? Because on a lower level, as I wouldn't say Gedolim, but on a lower level, you know, there are rabbis who are Talmidei Chachamim who have gotten involved in these issues, and they've collected Torah sources on our obligation to the environment, and there are commandments in terms of preserving the environment. Not wasting, baltashkes, all of these other inyanim. Why the Gedolim don't issue pronouncements on it is, you know, it's an interesting question. I think part of it is that every human being, by definition, only has a limited amount of energy, and one has to prioritize the issues. And there is a feeling that if there are non-Jewish or government or private organizations that are devoting a lot of time and effort to this, and they're doing an okay job, and they're pushing it, so the Gedolim feel that we don't necessarily have to make everything a Jewish issue. Now, that's not to say, as an individual Jew, you can't get involved in it. But like Gedolim, you know, they have to marshal their time. They're not going to get involved in issues that are being adequately done by other sources. So my short answer is there has not been a lot of Gedolim pronouncements on global warming. Of course, one needs to also take a perspective in this too, and that is, I don't mean to suggest that global warming is necessarily a done deal. we have a responsibility for the environment, but whether there is a phenomenon of global warming or whether it has not been scientifically proven, you know, that's still a bit of an open question, and one can debate that. And you can't really expect Gedolim to be machria in a machlokas of scientists, right? So it's kind of, so basically the concept is some things can be left to the non-Jewish world, and they can debate it, and they can determine what should be done. And the individual Jews that are interested and feel that that is where they can make a positive contribution can be involved there. And more or less, you know, anything that protects the environment will generally be consistent with the Torah's scheme of values, and a Jew would be able to pursue it. The only thing that where you do get into a problem is not so much global warming, because that's a legitimate issue, but you get involved with, when you get involved with animal liberation movements like PETA. PETA is the organization People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Actually, it was founded by a Jewish fellow, the infamous Peter Singer, who is a professor at Princeton University and one of the leading bioethicists in the world, one of the leading philosophers in the world. And Peter Singer, he's probably an old man by now, but Peter Singer founded what was called the Animal Liberation Movement around 60 years ago. And he basically coined the idea that for human beings to think they're better than animals is speciesism. Just like there's racism between humans, there is speciesism. Why are you better than that animal? That animal could be a lot better than you. That is a philosophy that is profoundly dangerous and profoundly against the Torah. Although the Torah does prohibit causing pain to animals, that is 100% true. But to debase the human being that was created in the image of God and make him equal to the animal, that is a philosophy that is profoundly antagonistic to the Torah and to the Torah's description of the creation of man. So there are certain aspects of environmentalism that actually shade into apikorsis and kfira and heresy in terms of viewing the centrality of the human being in Hashem's plan. But something like global warming, I think, can be left to the realm of the scientific and the technical. And if it is concluded that the emission of carbon gases are detrimental to the human welfare, then halacha would say one should take steps to minimize that. I mean, that would be, you know, within the Torah.
Okay. Until it's concluded?
I say again?
Until it's concluded?
Well, I would say this. I would say that on a lot of scientific and factual questions, the Gedolim actually say, we don't know, so you as an individual have to make your decisions. That's an important, I think it's an important point. You know, a gadol is not going to tell you how to lead every last decision of your life. Meaning the gadol gives you the values. There are values here. You then have to decide, you know, whether a given phenomenon is against those values or not against those values. So I think a lot of times you do have to make your own decisions. And that's not only true in global warming. That's even true in Avod HaSashem. The gadol does not micromanage your life. I think some people misinterpret that. The gadol is there to be a source of inspiration and general guidance and information as to a Torah perspective. But how you apply that to your life is still very much an individual decision, together with your Rebbe or Talmud Chacham that knows you as an individual. Okay, I think what has happened in Eretz Yisrael, especially, is we have tended to look at the Gedolim to micromanage, like, you know, anyone that has an iPhone doesn't ever share in the world to come, etc. And at least in the non-Hasidic community, that has never been the Mahalach. The Mahalach has been that you have some autonomy and you have some independence and you have to work things out within that framework. Rav Yisrael Salanter once said a beautiful statement. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, Hasidim and Misnagdim are both wrong. Hasidim think that because they have a Rebbe, they don't have to think. And Misnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe. And they're both wrong. You need a Rebbe, and you need to think. Meaning to say, you can't use the Rebbe as a crutch, but you also need some connection to a Torah source to be able to give you that guidance and structure. So you need a Rebbe, and you need your mind at the same time. You need both of them at the same time. Yeah?
I was wondering, I had a couple of different opinions on, but I think it was my basic halacha, is when are you not considered Yotzei Minyan, example, the case of you walk in late to a midnight, you're doing a really short essay, and you still have things to do to catch up. When exactly is that point that you're lost in the
essay? Yeah, so really, it's really a machlokas. What can I tell you? There is a machlokas happosuk. That's why you'll hear two views. Rav Moshe Feinstein's shita was that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of davening b'tzivah, first of all, let me emphasize one point. Tefillah in Chazal always means Shemona Esrei. You don't have to say Kriya Shema with the in other words, if you're not up to the congregation with Kriya Shema, don't worry about it. Your goal is, in fact, that's why I tell people, if you want to make Shemona Esrei with the congregation, then start Kriya Shema, start davening a half an hour early and say Psukhi Dezimra at your own pace and say Birchas Kriya Shema at your own pace. Your goal, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, is you want to start with 9 other people, the Shemona Esrei. And according to Rav Moshe, if you don't start Shemona Esrei with dominion, you do not have the mitzvah of davening with the congregation. Now, you still have the mitzvah of answering Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, Kriyas HaTorah, those are good mitzvahs too, but you don't have the mitzvah of davening with the congregation. That's Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe is very strict. You actually gotta begin. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach is much more lenient, and maybe that's the psak you hear in Eretz Yisrael more. According to his position, as long as you start your Shemona Esrei when there's still a minyan davening, or 9 other people, davening Shemona Esrei, even if they're towards the end and you're towards the beginning, you still fulfill the mitzvah of tefillah b'tzibar. So according to Shlomo Zalman, it is less important, I mean, it's still better to start, but it's less important to start exactly with the tzibar than it would be according to Rav Moshe. By the way, there's another interesting shaila, and that is, what if, for example, I'm davening a different Shemona Esrei than the congregation. Now, this could come up. Maybe this actually happened to you. Let's say, for example, you're an Israeli and you're visiting America for Yom Tov. Okay? So on the second day of Yom Tov in America, right, or the last day of Pesach, the congregation is davening the Yom Tov davening. But you're davening a weekday or Chol HaMoed davening. Okay? Now, this wouldn't happen for the Shacharis of the eighth day because you'd have to daven with tefillin, and that would be private. But let's say it's mincha. Let's say it's mincha of the eighth day of Pesach, and you're Israeli. So you go to shul, and you're dressed in Yom Tov garments. You have to be dressed in Yom Tov garments, okay? And the tzibor is davening a Yom Tov Shemona Esrei for mincha, and you are davening a weekday Shemona Esrei for mincha. Everyone understands my hypothetical. Okay, so the question is, do you get the mitzvah of tefillah b'tzibur if you're davening a totally different Shemona Esrei? So here the poskim say, yeah, you're still davening with the congregation, and you get a certain merit for that.
Can I just ask a follow-up question on that?
Yeah.
On that case, if you held by that you should start the Shemona Esrei with the tzibur, as a Mariv, and they're about to start Shemona Esrei, would you start Shemona Esrei straight away as you walk in?
Okay, so let me explain. That's a very good question. Let me explain the difference between Shacharis and Mariv. There's a big difference. If I walk in to a shul and they're about to start Shemona Esrei in the morning, even like Rav Moshe that says I only get tefillah b'tzibur if I start, so you might think I should start davening, not allowed to. Because in the morning, there's an absolute chiyuv that you have to precede your Shemona Esrei with Geula, Gaul Yisrael, and you can't say that unless you say the Shema and the Brachas before the Shema. And therefore, in such a situation, you are mechuyev to essentially do Psukei Dezimra. Now, you could skip Psukei Dezimra if that would help you, but you say Baruch Shamar, Ashrei, Yishtabach. From Yishtabach on, you got to do the whole thing, and then you do Shemona. In other words, you cannot do Shemona Esrei without at least a minimal Psukei Dezimra and Yishtabach straight. Okay? And even if that means you're going to miss Tefillah B'Tzibur, you're going to miss Tefillah B'Tzibur, because to be Somek Gula L'Tefillah overrides Tefillah B'Tzibur. Okay, it's important. You do not just begin Shmon Esrei. Ma'ariv is a different situation. Ma'ariv, we paskin that although we do have Goel Yisrael and Hashkivenu to connect to Shmon Esrei, but that is considered to be more of an optional minhag. It's not an absolute requirement. And as a result, davening with a minyan will override the chiyuv of smichas gula l'tefillah. So if I walk in ma'ariv, and I know that if I'm going to begin, the Birchas Kriya Shema, I'm not going to be able to reach Shemon Esrei. I should just wait, start Shemon Esrei with them, and then say Kriya Shema and the Brachos after Ma'ariv. Okay.
From all of the Brachos.
Yes. The one thing you should not, The one thing you cannot do is you cannot split it. In other words, you can't say, okay, I'll say the first Brachos now, and I'll save the later Brachos later. Meaning, if you cannot say the whole thing before Shemon Esrei, then don't say anything before Shemon Esrei. I mean, I'll give an example. I mean, it happened to me sometimes when I wasn't davening for the Amid. If I came, let's say, I mean, I'm sure for most of us, if I come even 3 minutes late for Ma'ariv, say 3 minutes late, I will not be able to start Shemon Esrei with the Tzibur. Now, even though they might be davening for another 7 minutes or whatever, I would just wait for 7 minutes in order to start Shemon Esrei. Meaning, if you can't do the whole thing, then you don't start. In fact, that would actually mean an interesting thing. That would actually, let's say you always have admired slow. Let's say you'll never make it. So you have two solutions. Either you consistently begin your Ma'ariv early, which is the best answer, or alternatively, you never have admired before Shemon Esrei, and you always do it afterwards. That's not the best answer, because the chatchila, you try not to permanently deviate from the Seder HaTfila. But yes, for Ma'ariv, Tfila B'Tzibur overrides Smichas Gula L'Tfila. In Shachris, Smichas Gula L'Tfila overrides Tfila B'Tzibur. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's a bit of a contradiction for the Jew going into the working world. Not the standard one that we think of, you know, learning versus working, but being Mekayim the Mitzvah of supporting your family versus helping our enemies. For example, the doctor who saves the lives of people who are Rishayim, the engineer who's working for an oil company and helping that company make money that is not going to be used for anything good and will be certainly used for evil. So how much should a Jew consider these sorts of things? And like, what's the Jewish view on that? I mean, it seems to me like a large percentage of work options available in the world today can, you know, put money in the wrong places.
Well, you're 100% correct. I would not necessarily be as pessimistic as you in terms of like every job is gonna help a terrorist and the like. But certainly, when a person chooses their parnasa, they want to choose a parnasa that, in addition to the mitzvah of supporting a family and giving you time to learn and giving you an opportunity to do tzedakah, you want to choose a profession that also does something good in the world, that does what is called a tikkun olam, that improves society, that benefits society, even in a modest way. You know, you say, well, a guy who runs a makolot, well, you know, it benefits society. He's giving people what they need and the like. It doesn't have to be, you know, a Nobel Prize type of activity. But I think that when you're involved in a parnasa that enhances immorality, that causes evil to be stronger than otherwise would be, one should give thought that that's not an ideal profession for a person. Sometimes there might actually be averus involved, it might causing people to sin, you know. But even when you don't have the technical parameters of lifnei iver, as a Jew, you don't want to spend your life doing things that make society spiritually worse off than it otherwise would be. So that would be a cheshbon. You have to think about it. You have to think about it. But on the other hand, you're not going to get perfection. I mean, listen, the doctor who occasionally might treat a terrorist, who may go back and kill, you know, is still treating so many people, you know, who are good people, right? So the fact that there's something going to be negative, that's the nature of Olam Hazeh. I wouldn't say I'm not going to be a doctor because I might, in the course of 20 years, treat a bad guy who might commit a crime. You know, you have to look at the overall picture of this as well, you know.
So are oil companies, for example, Osser to work for, based on what the register said?
No, I wouldn't say that, because oil companies do provide services. I mean, oil companies do enable people to drive cars, factories to produce things. I think you are doing useful things. Now, could you work for a cigarette company, tobacco company? That's more of a shyla, you know. Does tobacco serve a positive function other than, you know, getting people lung cancer and emphysema, right? That's more of a question. Can you work for a casino? You know, maybe not, because you really can't identify positive, beneficial, spiritually uplifting things. An oil company, I think, is a different situation. Now, if the oil company engages in boycotts against Israel, you know, that's a separate issue. But the mere fact that it may put money in Arab coffers, I mean, listen, we're coming up to a Shemitah year now. Now, as you know, maybe we'll talk more about this as we get closer to Shemitah. One of the big controversies in Israel for 60, 70 years has been the fact that the Rabbanut symbolically sells all the lands in Israel to an Arab, and that enables the land to be farmed based on a psak of Rav Kook, because otherwise farmers would suffer, they'd have no way of surviving, and the like. Now, you also know that the more Haredi populations, based on the Chazon Ish, do not hold of the Heter Mechira at all. And the only produce they will use during Shemitah is either produce that is imported from Chutz La'aretz, or, this or is a big one, or produce that they buy directly from the Arabs. So the most Haredi segment of Eretz Yisrael during the Shemitah year buys stuff that is grown by Arabs in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now, where does that money go to? Right, the money that, some of it will go to just support a family, etc., but, you know, some of that money, that's why it's enormously controversial, meaning the issue you're raising is an issue that actually we're going to face in the Shemitah year, where some of the money that is being used in order to enhance the observance of Shemitah might be going to people who may use it in terrorist activities. I think there's a severe problem with that. It's one thing if you want to buy Chutz La'aretz produce, that's fine, but to actually support Arabs who are engaged in terrorist activities is a very, very severe problem. But that's an example of how your dilemma can crop up in these situations. Yeah.
Is it a bracha or a kala that it's been raining since after Pesach?
Oh, well, I know, obviously, we had rain yesterday. Had there been other rains before that?
Not heavy, heavy like it has been, but it has been...
You know, this is hard for me to say. The Mishnah in Tainus indicates, it's a Mishnah, that rain after the month of Nisan, or during the month of Nisan, is actually considered to be a curse. It's not considered to be a bracha. However, that may not apply here. In other words, the problem with rain in Nisan and Iyar and Sivan, besides the fact that it's very unusual, is that this is when the crops are ripening and are ready to be harvested. And when the grain has hardened for there to be water, that could cause the grains to spoil and rot. So it would seem to be a curse only in places where there's agriculture. Meaning to say, in other words, a rain that's limited to an urban area, per se, or to a desert area, would seem to be a bracha, no matter what. But in the places where we're growing crops, it's considered to be a klala. So I'm not sure how widespread. Do you know, has this rain been widespread throughout the country, or just...
flash floods in the desert.
Say again? Right.
There were flash floods.
Yeah. Well, it is unusual, and... as I say, the only explicit reference we have is that it's a simen klala. I'm trying to suggest that it wouldn't necessarily be a simen klala outside of an area that's growing crops, but I don't have a definitive raya for that. Now, you may have heard also as well that the month of Iyar does have a certain bracha to it. It's a bracha for refuah if someone is ill. Have you heard this? Is famous Rashi Teva, that the word Iyar is an abbreviation, ani, Yud Yud is Hashem. Ani Hashem Rofecha. I am Hashem, your healer. It's a pasuk in the Torah. And therefore, we say on one end, Iyar is Mesugal for Refuah. So, I don't know. Yeah?
My question on
Tefillin
is, when Kaddish is being said, is
said by the composer. And you are, and I've heard that you can never speak during Kaddish. Can't speak during Kaddish, that's Asura, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So what happens if you're saying something else? Like you're in our neder and Kaddish comes up. First, two parts of that. One, oh no, sorry, take something that you're sitting down, like Tachanun.
Yep.
And you're sitting down. So one, you're not standing for Kaddish.
Yep.
And two, you're in the middle of work. What do you do?
Well, optimally, the best thing to do is actually stop for all of Kaddish, all of Kaddish. But that is the best thing to do. But it's not an absolute chiyuv. It's one thing you're not allowed to talk. That's sichas chulin. But if you're Isaac and davening, so technically, although you stop and you answer, you're not mechuyev to stop your davening while the Kaddish is being recited. And in terms of standing as well, even standing, many people are mekel that allow you to sit during Kaddish except when you say Yehesh Mei Rabbah. So according to that, you would just stand for Yehesh Mei Rabbah and then you could go back to sitting, etc. Okay, so the best thing is to stop for all of Kaddish, but it's not a chiyuv. The chiyuv is to stop to Yehesh Mei Rabbah and the omeis, yeah.
I saw, halacha, that you're allowed to read Tehillim for a healthy person.
I'm sorry, you're talking about Shabbos? What are you talking about?
In those types of things, you're allowed to do magic and believe, and you're allowed to believe in lucky things.
Yes.
And one of them was like about reading Psukim on a team or doing like a special thing before in Brit Miller.
Oh, I see.
And I was wondering if a healthy person, you're allowed to read.
Well, obviously, you know, there are people that say Tehillim every day. There are people that finish Tehillim every week, you know, so obviously we're not going to say, you know, it's not going to read Tehillim. Basically, it all depends on how you're using it. There are certain subtleties here that are hard to define, and that is, when you say Tehillim as a way of praying to the Almighty, I am praying to Hashem. When I say the words Hoshea, you know, I am asking Hashem for Yeshua, that's absolutely mutter. I mean, that is davening to Hashem by the words of Tehillim, and that is mutter for sick, for healthy, for children, for adults. That is always permitted, because that is tefillah, and there's never going to be a time when Hashem says tefillah is not proper. However, Tehillim were used, or psukim were used, in kind of a magical, superstitious way, in which you weren't even concentrating on the words. It was just like, these syllables will do certain things. And that's really what Chazal are talking about, where you're using the words of Torah in a magical, superstitious way. The same way nonsense syllables, abracadabra. By the way, I'm sure you heard, abracadabra is a corruption of an Aramaic formula. It says, evra kedabra. I want to create as God created with his divine words. Abracadabra, okay. whatever it is, but when you use them as a magic spell, that is when it becomes nifash. But when we say Tehillim before, you know, we're really praying for the baby. Hashem should protect the baby. That is a mutter. That's a mutter, and that's a mitzvah to do.